Imagine, you are shoeless and dressed in a kilt, a woolen shirt and a leather waistcoat. In one hand you have a small, round wooden shield with a covering of leather, and in the other a steel sword. In your belt you have a loaded single-shot pistol. Alongside you in rows are your cousins, your brothers, uncles and other distant relatives, men you have known all your life, all similarly dressed. You are standing on a marshy, mossy moor, with thick heather and tufts of grass grabbing at your ankles. In the distance across the moor are dozens of large field guns that seem to be pointing directly at you. Between them are rows and rows of red-coated disciplined soldiers, each carrying a bayoneted rifle. You are very tired. You have had little sleep for 30-odd hours because you and your family wasted the night walking 20 miles. All you have had to eat for 2 days is a few oatmeal biscuits and a little milk stolen from a farm in the night. You are cold and soaking. Driving rain and sleet is blowing directly into your face on a bitterly cold northeast wind. To your left and right are similar ranks of men, dressed as you are. Agitated, anxious, and only just holding their discipline. You have been waiting for what seems an eternity for the coming battle. When the first shouts went up at 8 a.m. that the enemy was nearing your camp, disturbing the few moments of sleep you had grabbed, you knew it would come to this. All the months of marching and skirmishing could end in no other way. You see the tufts of smoke from the guns long before you hear the explosions. Instinctively you turn your shield to protect your face and upper torso, just as a cannonball plunges into the ground a few feet ahead of you. It sends shards of white-hot metal spinning through the air. Thankfully the soft boggy ground muffles the explosion so the shards miss you and your colleagues. Moments later more smoke from the guns, and this time a shard embeds itself in your shield whilst another causes your cousin alongside you to scream, blood pouring from a deep gash in his calf. This barrage goes on for 20 agonizing minutes, men screaming, smoke filling the air so you can no longer see the enemy across the fields, and the smell of burning flesh and fear causing you to retch. Every instinct is telling you to run, get out of there, but no one moves. Each man looks to any brother, cousin or uncle still standing for guidance, but still no one moves. Suddenly, to your left, others are running. Not running away, but running towards the guns. Then, like some mass hysterical Mexican wave, those to their right run until you too find yourself running headlong into those murderous guns. The heather claws at your feet. Your cousin, his blood-soaked leg forgotten in a wave of adrenaline and fear alongside you. You are away from the following cannonballs now. They are sailing over your head, landing in the abandoned mud. You feel safer here. The smoke covers the enemy. But you know that it covers you too. You have your sword and shield, and experience tells you that the shieldless redcoats always run away when charged at. You're about halfway to the enemy, your heart trying to charge by itself, every pain, every hunger pang forgotten as you concentrate on keeping your feet in the marsh. You're now just a few yards away. The guns have been depressed to fire ahead. But you know they can only take out one person at a time, and as long as you avoid the ball, then you can take your fear out on the redcoats. The guns open fire. This time they fire grapeshot. Small balls of metal that burst from the cannon, scattering and taking out dozens of attackers simultaneously. To your right, your cousin flies backwards, as do several men to his right. But you can't stop now. You can see the whites of their eyes. Pulling your pistol out of your belt, You discharge it into the mass of red ahead of you, but fail to see if there's any result before throwing the pistol into the mud. A searing pain in your left ear causes you momentarily to stumble, but you use the momentum of your run to gather your feet before you raise your sword with your right hand to slash the red-coated figure ahead of you. He has his bayonet rifle pointed to your left. This is ideal because you know your shield will easily deflect any attempt he can make to slash you. Just as you are about to bring your weapon onto the head of the redcoat, your world stops. Your right arm is pulled into your body, and you feel the bayonet enter your right side. This was not meant to happen. His bayonet was on your left, your shield side. Where did this bayonet come from? Looking right, you see another redcoat with fear in his eyes pulling his bayonet out of your side. Turning left, you see the redcoat whose skull you tried to slice open pulling his bayonet out of your brother alongside of you. You pass out. Hours later, you come around, blood pouring from your side and your head. You know you're dying and want it to end. You see your brothers, cousins and uncles lying still on the blood-soaked mud. Rough hands grab your sword from your hands, and you hear a shout in an alien language. The red-coated figure looks down at you. He points your sword at your breastbone, before pushing down on it. So ended the Battle of Culloden, April 16th, 1746. To understand why the Highland clansmen were doomed to be slaughtered against the red wall of government troops, we need to go back 58 years to 1688, when the last Catholic monarch, James II and 7th of England and Scotland respectively, was deposed in favour of the Protestant Anne and her husband William of Orange. James was exiled to France, and on his death his son, another James, took on the mantle of James III and 8th, but he remained uncrowned and in exile on the continent. His aborted attempt at regaining the crown in 1715 by an invasion and rally of his Scots supporters ended in ignominy and his return to France with his tail between his legs. Now, anyone who supported the return of the Catholic James over the Protestant Hanoverian Georgies were known as Jacobites, from the Latin version of James, Jacob. Their reasons for what many described as treasonous thoughts were varied. Religious, political, economic, and even romantic conservatism. And for most of the first half of the 18th century, there were several other attempts, mostly on a small scale, at uprisings in the traditional Jacobite heartlands of the Scottish Highlands and in the west of Ireland. All were abortive and unsuccessful. In 1745, it was the turn of James's son. Charles, Edward, Louis, John, Casimir, Sylvester, Severino, Maria, Stuart, you probably know him better as Bonnie Prince Charlie. Now, Charles was born in Rome in 1720, and he spent most of his childhood in Italy. His portraits show him as a handsome man, and several accounts exist telling of his charm and dashing good looks, and he was raised in an air of privilege and inculcated with the belief that God has set his father up to be the rightful king of England, Scotland and Ireland, and it was to be his destiny to fulfil that divine command. Now, the prince, aided by a few supporters, landed on the island of Eriskay off the far west of Scotland. He was supposed to have had French troops and arms in support, but the ship carrying most of these had been damaged and had returned to France. He therefore had no choice but to raise his army from the traditionally supportive Highlanders. Now, the clans of the Highlands were essentially the remains of medieval feudalism. The clan chief, however, was more than just a landlord. He was the father or patriarch of the clan. He was the one who held near divine lordship over his tenants, and they would do whatever he commanded. But with that came an understanding that there was also an element of responsibility and inclusiveness that tempered the abuse of power to some extent. The decisions made by the chief were understood to be for the good of all the clan, for the whole family, not just for him and his family alone. The prince tried to gather as many fighting men as he could, but there was an initial reluctance in many of them. Some, like the chief of the clan Chisholm, made sure that he had sons fighting on both sides. That way he could ensure his family did not suffer retribution, just as they'd done after the 1715 rebellion. The historian Tom Steele put it, "The prince rallied little over half the fighting strength of the Highlands to his cause. Most of these gave their support for feudal reasons, others, Episcopalian and Catholic, for religious reasons. Few took up arms because they believed in the rebellion politically. Many Highlanders saw the forthcoming campaign as a chance to revive, on a grand scale, the traditional rape of the Lowlands." Now, by the 19th of August that year, the prince had gathered around 1,200 men to Glenfinnan in the far west of Scotland. The first months of the campaign were inordinately successful, and by the 4th of September, he'd taken Perth, 2 weeks after that, the capital, Edinburgh. Government officials fled the city in panic, and more and more troops rallied to Charles' cause. He had some French and Irish troops alongside him, but nothing, to be honest, like the numbers he'd hoped for. The only standing government force in Scotland capable of challenging the rebels was led by General Cope, whose forces had been outmanoeuvred by the prince and were left well behind to the north. Cope eventually shipped his troops from Dundee to Dunbar on the east coast ahead of the prince to gain an advantage and marched them back northwest towards Edinburgh. Now, the forces eventually met near the village of Preston Pans, which is now a suburb of the city. Now, when Cope's forces were routed after only 5 minutes by the charging Highlanders, and the victory meant that the prince now effectively ruled Scotland, and previously reluctant lords rushed to his side, bringing with them personal armies of feudal warriors. Charles even set up a full court in Holyrood House, where he entertained the great and good of Edinburgh society. Meanwhile, there was general panic when the news of Cope's defeat reached London. So the king's government recalled troops from Holland, and under the command of the seasoned campaigner General Wade, alongside the king's younger son, the Duke of Cumberland, set about raising enough troops to destroy the upstart rebels. In a London theatre, the audience sang a new verse to the national anthem, calling on General Wade to, "like a torrent, rush rebellious Scots to crush," which remains in the British national anthem to this day, albeit in a verse that is rarely ever sung. The prince's troops were effectively managed by Lord George Murray, but he and the prince often disagreed. Charles, against Murray's advice, decided to invade England and take the British crown for his exiled father. Again, the prince had remarkable success. Carlisle on the English border fell on the 15th of November, then Penrith, Lancaster, Preston and Manchester, and by the 4th of December the army was in Derby, just over 100 miles north of London. They must have made a remarkable sight to the people of the north of England. No Scots army had been this far south in generations, and here they were marching down the main road. Never having seen wild-eyed, heavily armed Highlanders before, they must have seemed like alien creatures. One can imagine women gathering up their children in barring doors, praying fervently that the monsters would pass their cottage and leave it unscathed. Charles had, just as he'd done against Cope, the good fortune to get ahead of the pursuing armies, this time of Cumberland and Wade. And apart from a militia army posted on the road south into the city, nothing stood between 5,000 Highlanders and London. Again, I'll quote Tom Steele. "The shops of London closed, and the Bank of England, fearing a run on money, paid out in sixpences. Charles and his favourites demanded an advance on London. Given the consternation there, it is not impossible that London might have fallen." But on the 6th of December, the long march northwards began again. The Highlanders were, in the main, the ones who wanted to return. They were a long way from home. Their reasons for their involvement in the rebellion was, as I said earlier, as much to do with economics and loyalty to the chief as it was ideological. They were loaded with booty, and had no desire to face a far superior force in an alien landscape. This is not to denigrate their fighting skills, nor their loyalty to the prince, but the Highlanders were in the main a simple feudal peasants. Their martial abilities, fearsome as they were, worked best on a familiar landscape, where a rushing charge put the fear of God into even disciplined troops, especially if they could not easily react to a fast-manoeuvring attacker, or if they could not quickly deploy artillery or cavalry in defence. The army made its way northwards. Charles left 400 troops to guard Carlisle Castle, but when this fell later, all the officers were hanged and the men transported to servitude in the West Indies. After persuading a reluctant population of Glasgow to resupply them, They faced a small government force at Falkirk on the 17th of January, and like it Preston Pans, easily won the day. The prince still retreated into the Highlands, eventually reaching Inverness and taking its castle on the 20th of February. The reason was, the government had sent the young Duke of Cumberland and his army northwards in pursuit. By the 14th of April, the Duke was encamped in Nairn, 10 miles or so from Inverness. The Jacobites tried an abortive night attack, but they arrived too late, finding the Duke's men awake, so they retreated back to Dromossey Moor near the village of Culloden, where they made camp. Now the Duke saw that they marched all night, and he quickly seized the day. He marshalled his forces to pursue the tired, hungry mass of Highlanders, and the two armies faced each other on the rain-lashed moor around midday. The prince had around 5,000 troops, mostly non-professional soldiers. A quarter of a mile away were around 9,000 well-disciplined, well-armed professionals, mostly made up of Lowland Scots and English regiments, but even with some Highland armies mixed in, especially supplied by loyal clans like the Campbells. The initial barrage from Cumberland's guns was devastating, and the prince seemed to be caught like a startled rabbit as his troops were indiscriminately mown down for 20 or so minutes. But once the traditional charge was underway, the Highlanders were in their element. However, Cumberland, having seen the defeats at Falkirk and Preston Pans, had been working on a plan. He drilled the well-disciplined troops so that instead of trying to bayonet the man who was attacking them and having the bayonet deflected by the shields, they learned instead to bayonet the man to their right. Because the Highlander had his right arm held aloft to bring it down onto the head of another redcoat, their right side was easily punctured by the unexpected bayonet. It called for a lot of trust in your colleagues. Whilst you protected the man beside you, you had to ensure that the man beside you to your left was protecting you. But it also meant that even though the Highlanders had got through the hail of shots, they could not inflict the usual damage as they'd done before at Preston Pans, and so the battle was over very quickly. Most accounts say there was only an hour or so of actual fighting. Around 1,200 Highlanders and 364 government troops were killed. The prince fled before the battle was over. Cumberland's retributions were swift and bloody. The wounded were killed where they lay. Anyone caught in the surrounding area suspected as being on the field or having supported the prince was summarily executed. To this day, Cumberland is known as Bloody Cumberland to Scots. He became a near dictator of the Highlanders, rooting out any suspected Jacobites as he found them, and he wrote to the Prime Minister later, "Jacobite rebellious spirit is so rooted in the nation's mind that this generation must be pretty well wore out before this country will be quiet." He effectively set out to exterminate the Highland way of life. All the cultural artefacts of centuries of living, such as tartan and kilts and carrying of weapons, were outlawed. Any clan chief who fought for the prince had his lands forfeited and his castle was burned to the ground. Many faced exile or execution. It effectively tore away the traditions and culture and made clearances of the late 18th and 19th centuries almost inevitable. As for the prince, he hid in the Highlands for 5 months, disguising himself frequently to avoid capture. There was a price of £30,000 on his head, a vast sum of money when the average Highlander was lucky to own goods worth a pound or so. He was never turned in. He escaped to the continent and died years later, an impoverished, penniless alcoholic, the prince over the water. His story is a romantic one, and the moor at Culloden is a poignant, sad place. If you ever come to Scotland or you live here and have never been there, I cannot recommend the visitor centre at the place highly enough. The place stands as a monument not to the hubris of a prince and the petty squabbles of politics or religion or to dynasty, but to the courage and melancholy of the ordinary Highlanders who fought here, not knowing that this was a last hurrah for a way of life that was soon to be lost forever. I guess I owe anybody that's listened to the previous podcast an apology. It's been 3 years since my last podcast. there should have been more, there should have been extra episodes, I should have kept it up, but to be fair, as John Lennon once said, life is what happens to you while you're busy making plans. So, unfortunately, life kind of got in the way over the last few years, but by chance I happened to visit stumble upon the website that I originally set up for this, and completely, not say forgotten all about it, but it had gone to the back of my mind. So I checked out the email address, which I hadn't looked at in ages as well, and lo and behold, there's quite a number of emails from people saying, please do another episode. So, okay, let's give the public what they want, as they say. Thank you for listening. I hope you get some information or knowledge. Please don't think this is a scholarly history. As I said, I am a history buff. I love the history of the country I live in and that I come from. I am widely read, but I'm no historian, I'm no historical scholar in any fine detail. So, you know, don't take my word for all of this. Go and work it out for yourself. Go and look at the sources. Go and check it out. There's lots of books out there. I might do a podcast soon on history books and my recommendations, but there's lots of information, and I appreciate if you go and find out for yourselves in a lot of detail as you require. Anyway, if you want to give me more feedback, I'd really appreciate it. If there's any subjects that you'd like covered, can't promise to do them or when they'll do them, but they'll give me some challenges and some focus on what people want to hear, just let me know. My email address is scotshistory, that's all one word, scots, S-C-O-T-S, history, @gmail.com. So let me know how you feel, and until the next episode, slantcha.